Welcome to our continuing Bible study in the Gospel of Mark. Good to have you joining us this evening. Hope everything's going well in your home, that everybody is well and safe. We're continuing this study tonight, following along the correspondence course that Gary Fisher has written on the Gospel of Mark. We'll be in Lesson 4 tonight. That begins in the last few verses of Mark chapter 4. We'll continue on through Mark chapter 5 and the first part of Mark chapter 6 tonight. If you're interested in enrolling in that correspondence course, you can go to our website, eastside-church.org, and click on the Study at Home banner, go to the correspondence courses, and select the Mark course, and be happy to enroll you in that. You can take it either through regular snail mail or through the internet online. So we encourage you to take that course, but we're happy that you can join us for this particular Bible study tonight. In the first part of the Gospel of Mark, we've seen Jesus being introduced by John the Baptist and many people following Jesus because of John's testimony about him. And then Jesus comes and he calls disciples. He begins preaching a gospel of repentance, telling them that the kingdom of heaven is at hand. And as I said, calling disciples, performing miracles, many people throng to him because of his amazing ability to perform miracles and the fantastic teaching that he's doing. Then when we got to Mark chapter 4, we saw that he spent some time there just teaching in parables, and we looked at those parables in our last lesson. Tonight, we're going to go back to focusing on, or Mark will, and we'll follow him, in focusing on Jesus performing miracles. And in this particular section that we'll be looking at tonight, Jesus really does a lot of things that men, of course, would consider to be impossible, but for him, as the Son of God, his power was on full display, and it's clear that he does things with great ease that you and I could never even think about doing, because indeed he is the Son of God. So the miracles that we'll look at tonight testify to the power of Jesus. It's not just a miracle that you're looking at, they're teaching events. We learn about the power and the identity of Christ by studying these miracles, but we'll also learn some lessons about the nature of faith, and faithlessness on a couple of occasions as we go through these miracles tonight. So I encourage you to study along with us, and we'll pick up the reading in Mark chapter 4 and verse 35. It says, on the same day when evening had come, he said to them, let us cross over to the other side. Now this is the same day that he taught all those parables. So he's had a long day of teaching, but he tells his disciples, let's get in the boat and we'll go to the other side of the Sea of Galilee. He and his disciples enter the boat, and it says, when they left the multitude, they took him along in the boat as he was, this is verse 36, and other little boats were also with him. A great windstorm arose, and the waves beat into the boat so that it was already filling, but he was in the stern asleep on a pillow. And they awoke him and said to him, teacher, do you not care that we are perishing? Then he arose and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, peace, be still. And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. But he said to them, why are you so fearful? How is it that you have no faith? And they feared exceedingly and said to one another, who can this be, that even the wind and the sea obey him? So this miracle we label as Jesus stilling the storm. He's, as we said, been teaching in parables, wants to cross over the sea. He and his disciples enter the boat, and they do that. And this great storm arises. I don't know if you've ever been on a body of water when a storm arose, especially one unexpected and came on quickly. A lot of wind, maybe some rain, waves getting high. I was in a boat with my brother-in-law a number of years ago, and this happened to us. It was truly terrifying. And I'm sure these men were very frightened of it, even though they were fishermen and used to being on the sea, at least four of them were. They were very, very afraid. They knew the danger that they were in, and sometimes their experience as fishermen may have told them just how much danger they were in. Perhaps they'd even seen others perish on storms in this little sea in Galilee. But Jesus seems entirely unconcerned about it all. He's asleep on this pillow, and the disciples wake him. They're terrified. They say, do you not care that we are perishing? We're about to die here. Doesn't that concern you? Don't you care about what's happening to us? And of course, Jesus is apparently not afraid and is not concerned about what will happen. He knows that he has power. He is, after all, the Son of God, and he is in control of anything that he wants to be. So he rebukes the wind and the sea, saying, "Peace, be still." The word for peace there, it's typically translated peace in most of our modern translations, but really it's the Greek word for quiet. So if you just shout to somebody, you know, your neighbor's being noisy or something like that, and you say, "Hey, be quiet," or you're a teacher at school and you tell the kids, "Be quiet." But Jesus tells the storm, "Be quiet. Be quiet and be still. Stop all of this." And immediately there is this great calm. It's not, again, something that happens gradually over a long period of time. You know, by 2 or 3 hours, the storm's sort of subsided. That's not what happens. There's this great calm. Jesus then turns to his disciples, as we read, and he rebukes them for their fear and their lack of faith. The word fear here is an interesting word. It's a word that really means timid. And it's not so much that it describes them as being terrified, as it describes them as being not brave, not courageous, more is the concept of it. So they are timid. They are not courageous. They're fearful. And it all stems from their lack of faith in him. Now, you have to remember, this is fairly early on in their relationship with Jesus. And they've seen amazing miracles, a lot of amazing miracles already. They understood something of Jesus' power, but they had yet to fully trust it, and it would be some long time, actually, before they did. But they don't have the faith that they should. But when they see what has happened, it says, now they feared exceedingly. You know, they lacked courage before. They were timid before. But now they had something to really be afraid of. We'll talk about this some more in just a minute. They said to one another, though, "Who can this be?" So you see, the miracle identifies who Jesus is. His power, his divine power, is on display in this miracle. Surely only God could control the elements like this. They understand a little bit of who they're dealing with now. "Who can this be?" they say. "Who can this be that even the wind and the sea obey him?" A little bit of background about the Sea of Galilee. Of course, Jesus has done a lot of teaching around here already. We've talked about his some time he spent in Capernaum, which is right on the coast, and other places around the sea already, and we'll be continuing to look at events around the Sea of Galilee for the biggest part of our lesson tonight. But the Sea of Galilee is a sort of pear-shaped lake. The length from north to south is 13 miles. The maximum width is about 8 miles. Its depth is 157 feet, but interesting part fact about the topography of this area is that the lake itself is 686 feet below sea level. This rift valley that flows from the Sea of Galilee down the Jordan to the Dead Sea, and you get to the Dead Sea, and it's actually the lowest place that you can be on earth and still be on earth. It's several hundred feet further even below sea level. So the elevation here is part of the reason that storms can develop so quickly, because there are mountains around. There are pretty good size mountains right around the Sea of Galilee, and then not too far away there's some ginormous mountains, very large mountains as well. And so this change in elevation can create wind currents that, if a front's coming through, can stir up a storm pretty quickly. I noticed a number of years ago, this was back in 2006, that Galilee was in the news for having some pretty bad storms. This storm pictured here occurred in April of 2006, and the newspaper, the Israel News, interviewed a man who said, "Believe me, it was like a tsunami." I don't think he knows what a tsunami is. That's a tidal wave, so it probably wasn't really like a tidal wave, but maybe the waves were like that on the Sea of Galilee. I don't know. But he says, "I thought Hurricane Katrina had come to Israel." So, you know, again, storms on the Sea of Galilee are real events. If you live like we do here in North Alabama, you can kind of appreciate that picture of a tornado. We have more than our share of them around here. They're terrifying events. You can only imagine, again, being on a large lake as the Sea of Galilee is, and having something like that happen. Jesus is truly divine. He demonstrates the power of God Almighty. He does the impossible, doesn't he, when he stills this storm. What do we learn from this event about different kinds of fear? The apostles, or the disciples at this point, had two kinds of fear. They had a fear where they lacked to be courageous, where they failed to be courageous in the face of the storm. That's one kind of fear, and it's because they didn't really have faith in Jesus. But then when they saw what he did in stilling the storm, they had another kind of fear. It was this sense of awe and great respect for Jesus and the power that he wielded. There are some kinds of fear that are good. When we fear God Almighty for his power, for what he can do in this world, for being the creator and the controller of all, that's a pretty healthy fear. When we have a kind of fear that causes us to fail to be courageous, to be brave for the Lord, to fail in our faith, that's a different kind of fear, and it's not good. But you see those contrasted right here in this particular miracle. Jesus continues around the Sea of Galilee, and now they've made it across, and we'll pick up the reading in chapter 5 and verse 1. They came to the other side of the sea, the country of the Gadarenes. Some translations, instead of Gadarenes there, may say Gergesenes, perhaps, or maybe even Gerasenes. So there are about three different words that various translations use, either in Mark's account, maybe in one of the other synoptic accounts, Matthew or Luke, about this particular event. So there are those who doubt the truthfulness of the Bible, who want to take pot shots at it and deny its inspiration, deny that it's from God. And this is one little place they go and say, well, you know, the gospel writers couldn't even decide, didn't even know what city it was. Well, actually, they did. There are actually three towns on the far side of the Sea of Galilee. If you look at this map, we can see that. One of them is Gergesa, another is Gadara, and another one that's not in this picture is Gerasa, but they're all on this eastern side of the Sea of Galilee. And it doesn't say in the text that, you know, that Jesus went to the city or the town. It says he comes to the country. So some of these towns, Gadara particularly, is a good bit bigger than Gergesa would have been. So, you know, I could say today, if you're familiar with the geography of North Alabama, I could say, well, I'm headed toward Huntsville, but I might wind up in Madison or New Hope or someplace else. And we kind of use the big town as a reference point for the whole region. And the gospel writers apparently do that on this occasion. So there's this area, this region, where you had these towns. All of them are on that side. And it's completely geographically correct to name them as this is the area where Jesus is going. So we go back to the story in Mark chapter 5 and now in verse 2. They came out of the boat. Immediately there met him a man out of the tombs, a man with an unclean spirit, who had his dwelling among the tombs, and no one could bind him, not even with chains. So here's a man who is demon-possessed. It's interesting that Matthew's gospel in Matthew chapter 8, in telling this account, mentions that there are actually two men with demons, but both Mark and Luke only focus on one. There were evidently two, but there's one that they focus on particularly. So they meet this man coming out of the tombs who had this unclean spirit. And what we learn about him is that he is not capable of being bound. They can't tie him up. They can't restrain him. It says he'd often been bound with shackles and chains, and the chains had been pulled apart by him, the shackles broken in pieces. Neither could anyone tame him. And always, night and day, he was in the mountains and in the tombs, crying out and cutting himself with stones. So here's a man who is horribly tormented with unclean spirits. He is not in control of his faculties. He is not in control of himself. The demons have taken him over, and he's just living this miserable life, being controlled, basically, by them. This is sort of an illustration of how Satan would like all of us to be, as miserable as possible. If he gets control of your life and demon possession does not occur anymore, the Bible plainly teaches us that when Jesus would come and bring open up the fountain of for forgiveness, that the unclean spirits would pass out of the land, because Zechariah teaches us that. But the point is, Satan still is very active, and he wants to get control of your life, and he wants to do that to make you miserable. He may make things look to be pleasurable, but he's going to wind up making you miserable. And he had pleasure in doing that with this particular man, these unclean spirits. So here's this man. He's dwelling in the mountains, in the tombs, a very bleak existence, 24/7, cutting himself, crying out. And then he runs when he sees Jesus in verse 6. When he saw Jesus from afar, he ran to worship him. He cried out with a loud voice, saying, "What have I to do with you, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I implore you by God that you do not torment me." So this man, the demons speaking through him, identify Jesus as the Son of God. That's a very interesting thing. It happens on more than one occasion when Jesus casts out demons. The demons, of course, are spirit beings. They somehow recognize Jesus, the Son of God, from the spirit realm, and they're able to identify him. Even though, you know, he's in fleshly form, they're inhabiting a fleshly being, yet they identify who Jesus is. It's not particularly testimony that Jesus wants or needs, but the reality is these demons can recognize him. This particular demon, or demons as we come to find out, doesn't want Christ, who has authority here, to torment him. The demons recognize that Jesus has power. He had power over the sea just a little bit earlier, and now they recognize he has power over them. So they ask him not to torment. He said, for he had said to them, "Come out of the man, unclean spirit." And then he asked them in verse 9, "What is your name?" And he answered, saying, "My name is Legion, for we are many." So we learn there are a lot of demons inhabiting this particular man. He begged them earnestly that he would not send them out of the country. Now a large herd of swine was feeding there near the mountains. So all the demons begged him, saying, "Send us to the swine that we may enter them." And at once Jesus gave them permission. This is a fascinating dialogue between Jesus and these demons. And it shows on Jesus' part that Jesus isn't like the devil. You know, the devil's going to hurt you any way that he can. Jesus knows how much power he has. The demons themselves recognize their power, his power over them. And so they're basically asking for a bit of mercy. They probably deserve to be sent out of the country, or, as another account says, into the abyss. But that's not what Jesus does. He sends them into this herd of swine. And so they entered the swine. There were about 2,000. And the herd ran violently down the steep place into the sea and drown in the sea. This is a picture of that eastern side of the Sea of Galilee, near Gergesa. That's modern Cursa, scholars believe. So it's kind of hard to see on a flat picture the depth of this, but those trees down there by the Sea of Galilee are full-grown trees. So taking this picture, you're up on a bluff, and you can imagine 2,000 pigs, they get to running ahead of steam, and they get to going down this very steep incline, and there's no stopping until they get into the sea, and they drown there, according to the text. It's a fascinating story, and it tells us again of the power of Christ. We see he's in control of even a horrifying situation, what would be a horrifying situation to any normal man. Yet Jesus is in complete control of all of this, casting out this legion of demons. The story doesn't end there, though. We find in the next few verses a reaction of people who dwell in the land and of the man himself. So let's continue. We'll pick up the reading in verse 14. So those who fed the swine fled, and they told it in the city. Those who fed the swine fled, and they told it in the city and in the country, and they went out to see what it was that had happened. So the swine herders, probably Gentiles, almost certainly so. There are a lot of Gentiles on the eastern side of the Sea of Galilee. We might talk about that some more in just a moment. But they go and tell everybody around, and people come from the area then to see what has happened. They came to Jesus and saw the one who had been demon-possessed and had the legion sitting and clothed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. And also those who saw it told them how it happened to him who had been demon-possessed and about the swine. So they tell these people, here's what happened. They can see evidence. The man who has been, you know, acting crazy and probably terrifying everybody in the whole area, he's sitting there clothed in his right mind. Looks like a perfectly normal person, apparently. But they recognize him as this crazy man they'd been having to deal with for however long. They see what has happened. They begin to plead with him to depart from their region. Some people might wonder why that is the case. Well, first of all, they'd lost 2,000 swine in what had happened. So that might have been one of the reasons. They could have just been terrified of Jesus' power, which could possibly be another reason. There could be others as well. But instead of wanting Jesus to stay, they ask him to leave. They don't understand exactly who he is, but they're spooked, to say the least, about what has been done. So he got in the boat, and he who had been demon-possessed begged him that he might be with him. This formerly demon-possessed man, realizing what's been done for him, so thankful to Jesus, wants to follow Jesus at this point, wants to get in the boat with him and be with him, and certainly we can understand that, somebody who has so changed a person's life. And I just, again, think about how this parallels our situation today, where we who've been lost in sin, we come to Jesus and he forgives us our sin and this horrible fear of eternal torment and the torment in this life that sin brings to us. And all of that is gone because of the power of Jesus Christ. And we also want to follow him. All of us who've become Christians understand this yearning to be near Christ and to follow him. That's what this man was experiencing. He had such relief from great bondage, and now he wants to follow Jesus. But Jesus wants a connection with him, but he wants him to serve him in a different way than just coming with him in the boat. So he did not permit him to do that. He says, go home to your friends and tell them what great things the Lord has done for you and how he has had compassion on you. That's verse 19. So the text tells us that the man departed and began to proclaim in Decapolis all that Jesus had done for him, and all marveled. The man not only goes home and tells his friends, but he goes over this entire region, the Decapolis. The word Decapolis means 10 cities. And just a little bit of background, a little bit of geography on that. This was a group of cities on the eastern frontier of the Roman Empire, in both Judea and Syria. These 10 cities were not really an official league or political unit, but they were grouped together because of language, culture, location, political status. The Decapolis cities originally were centers of Greek and Roman culture. So here's cities that are sort of planted in this area. And the idea is, if you're Greek, especially if you're Roman during this time, you have a little bit of home, so to speak, in these cities. Some of us may have traveled abroad, and there are places abroad where maybe American Armed Forces have bases and things like that. You can get a little bit of America there. These places were more than just a little bit of Roman and Greek culture, some pretty good-sized cities. And so that's what these cities were. They'd be mainly occupied by Romans or Greeks, Gentiles, and not Jews, although there would be some Jews in some of these cities. Mark is the only one of the gospel writers to mention the Decapolis by name. He mentions it three times in his gospel. You can see that nine of the cities were actually on the eastern side, from Damascus to the north, all the way to Philadelphia in the south. One of the 10 cities was actually just over the Jordan River back on the western side, what we now call the West Bank, and that was the city of Scythopolis. I was privileged to visit there about 3 years ago, and it's a Bible city in the Old Testament known as Beth Shan, and here you see a picture of the Greek and Roman architecture there. Some of this is later than the first century. Some of it would have been there in the first century. In the mountain, the hill that you see in the background is the tell of Beth Shan from the Old Testament period. This is where Saul His body was hung there on the wall, you might remember in the Old Testament. So this is that same place. But in Jesus' time, this would have been a big city of Greco-Roman culture. Now, why am I telling you all of this? Well, this man who had the demons cast out of him, he goes around the Decapolis telling people about Jesus. You wonder how many others whom Jesus healed or cast demons out of, how many others went around telling the news like this? Maybe more than just a few. It's no wonder Jesus' popularity is just rising, you know, multiplying every day in these early days, especially of his ministry. This great Galilean ministry that he's involved in will bring many, many people to him, not just from the area of Galilee, because people who get healed, people who hear his teaching, they spread it far and wide. They're excited about who Jesus is. And he's going to have a good number of true believers follow him, and then just a lot of other people who are just interested in finding out who this person is and more about his powers. Jesus is truly doing the impossible. And in doing that, he's bringing many, many people to believe in him as the Christ, the Son of God. So that brings us to the next section of Mark chapter 5. And we'll begin reading in Mark chapter 5 and verse 21. Now Jesus had crossed over again by boat, so he goes back to the other side, to the western shore. Jesus crossed over again by boat to the other side, and a great multitude gathered to him. He was by the sea, and behold, one of the rulers of the synagogue came, Jairus by name. And when he saw him, he fell at his feet and begged him earnestly, saying, "My little daughter lies at the point of death. Come, lay your hands on her that she may be healed and she will live." So we're about to look at two miracles that are sort of intertwined together in the gospel accounts. One is the healing of Jairus' daughter, actually raising her from the dead by the time Jesus gets there. And the other is Jesus healing a woman who had an issue of blood. Both of these miracles, along with the previous miracle, would have involved in Jewish culture, according to Old Testament law, would have involved the participants in becoming unclean. If you're a demon, obviously, if you have a demon, you would have been unclean. If you touch a dead body, you are unclean. If you have an issue of blood, you are unclean. So there's a commonality in the miracles that Jesus is performing here, in that to the Jewish mind, these were not just bad events as far as we think about them, but from a spiritual standpoint, they make the person who's involved in these events unclean, or people even who are associated with some of these events might be considered to be unclean. And so that means you're cut off from temple worship. There are a number of privileges, spiritual privileges you can't involve yourself in. So to the Jewish mind, there's more to this than what we think about when we think about these terrible events. There's even more that they would be thinking about regarding how bad these events would be. Jesus, in returning to the western shore, meets here with Jairus, or Jairus comes to meet him, and Jesus goes with him. He says, I'll come. He went with him, and a great multitude, it says in verse 24, thronged him. But then, in the midst of Jesus going to help Jairus with his daughter, it says in verse 25, a certain woman had a flow of blood for 12 years and had suffered many things from many physicians. She'd spent all that she had and she was no better, but rather grew worse. There may be some listening to this lesson who have chronic illnesses. You've perhaps been to many doctors and you haven't gotten any better. Maybe you've spent a small fortune in treatments and tests and medications and still you've gotten no better. Extraordinarily frustrating. It's debilitating, not only physically, but emotionally as well. You get to a point where you're at your wit's end about these kinds of illnesses. And I know several, there are some here in the congregation at Eastside that suffer from these kinds of illnesses. It's tragic, and we all are saddened to see people having to go through this kind of thing. When she, this woman, saw Jesus coming through, when she heard about Jesus, she comes behind him in the crowd and touches his garment. Remember, she is unclean. You could go back to the book of Leviticus in chapter 15, verses 25 through 26, that talks about a woman during her customary flow of blood impurity would be unclean. But this woman's problem is constant, so she is constantly unclean for 12 years, really being cut off from many spiritual activities. She's suffered so much, and she spent a lot of time and effort seeking healing, as we've said. But when she touches Jesus, she's healed. She said, it says in verse 28, she said, "If only I may touch his clothes, I shall be made well." Self-talk is a good thing if we talk to ourselves in faith and encouragement. A lot of times we talk to ourselves in negative ways, and I suppose all of us do this, where we're talking down on ourselves or complaining about something that's happened, or we get negative in our minds. And this woman would have had every reason to, you know, think about things that way. But here in Jesus, she sees a hope. And so she turns from what may have been a very negative mindset to a very positive one. She has hope in Christ. She has faith in him. She truly believes that she could be healed if she just touches his garment. In fact, not only that she could be, but that she would be. She has tremendous faith in him. And it says in verse 29, then, that immediately the fountain of her blood was dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of the affliction. Jesus, immediately knowing in himself that power had gone out of him, turned around in the crowd and said, "Who touched my clothes?" But his disciples said to him, "You see the multitude thronging you, and you say, 'Who touched me?'" He looked around to see her who had done this thing. But the woman, fearing, trembling, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. So there's no need hiding anything from Jesus. The man who could heal a person just by having his garment touched surely would know that that happened and surely would know who did it. I don't think Jesus is asking who did this as if he didn't know. He's asking, I believe, to have the woman come forth and confess her faith. Jesus could heal surely anybody he wanted to. He got the power of God. His power is beyond our imagination even. He can know what's going on in this woman's heart. But he didn't necessarily heal just for the sake of healing. Most all of the time he's trying to teach about who he is or teach lessons of faith, and he does both of those things here. He wants the woman to confess her faith, but he also wants people around to understand why they should believe in him in this same way. So he concludes the conversation with her. After she tells him the whole truth, he says to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your affliction." What a wonderful story. And the woman, no doubt, is praising God and so thankful for the power of Jesus. But then in the next verse, while he was still speaking, some came from the ruler of the synagogue's house and said, "Your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher anymore?" Can you imagine being Jairus at this time? And you've come to get what you believe would be certain help for your daughter who is grievously sick. Jesus said he's coming, and perhaps you're thinking, hopefully he's going to get there and he'll be able to heal my daughter and everything's going to be fine. But while you're delayed a little bit, while Jesus is dealing with this woman, you get the news your daughter has died. And how crestfallen Jairus must have been. How tempted he would have been to lose both faith and hope at this particular moment in time. But notice what happens. As soon as Jesus heard the word that was spoken, he said to the ruler of the synagogue, "Do not be afraid, only believe." The disciples, what was their problem on the sea when the storm came up? They were afraid. They didn't have enough faith. Jesus sees the storm that's going on in the life of Jairus right now. He knows what he's going through. And he tells him, "You've got to have faith. Don't be afraid." Folks, we need to trust Jesus. We need to have faith in him. In the times that we're facing right now, in dealing with our spiritual problems, in dealing with family problems, whatever it might be, we've got to have faith. We've got to have faith in Jesus. He's powerful. Believe in him. Trust in him. He'll only want to do us good. No matter what happens in our life, we can trust him. And so Jesus goes on with him. And it says in verse 37, he got to apparently the house. He permitted no one to follow except Peter, James, and John, and the brother of James. And he came to the house of the ruler of the synagogue, saw a tumult, and those who wept and wailed loudly. He comes in and he says, why is this commotion? Why do you weep? The child is not dead, but sleeping. When the people hear this, they ridicule him. They think, you don't know what you're talking about. This girl is dead. She's really dead. They believe her to be dead. They know her to be dead. But Jesus says, no, she's just sleeping. One of the things we see about the difference between God and man here, to man, when a person is dead and we say they're gone. They're gone. There's no getting them back. To Jesus, somebody who's dead, they're not gone. He can bring them back as easy as you can rouse somebody out of sleep. Just by a touch, just by a word, he's going to be able to bring this girl back to life. You see the difference between looking at something from a human vantage point and looking at something from a divine vantage point. Jesus is the Son of God. He has the power of divinity within him. He knows fully what he's capable of doing. He knows that death is no match for him. The disciples didn't really know that yet, but he did. And so, as we go forward, he puts everybody out of the house, and he took the father and the mother of the child and those who were with him, those few disciples that he took, and he enters where the child is lying. And he took the child by the hand and said to her, Talitha kumi, which is translated, little girl, I say to you, arise. Immediately, the girl arose and walked, for she was 12 years of age, and they were overcome with great amazement. He commanded them strictly that no one should know it, and said that something should be given her to eat. Jesus, amazingly, is able to bring this little girl back to life. One of the fascinating things to me about this particular story is that this girl was 12 years old. It's only mentioned in passing, seemingly, as Mark explains why she was able to walk. She was a little girl, but she wasn't an infant, and she was old enough to walk. She's 12 years old, so she gets up and walks. That seems to be, at first, when you look at it, the point of why we're told that she's 12 years old. But you might remember that the woman with the flow of blood had that problem for 12 years. Could it be just coincidence that both of these problems have 12 years in the story? Maybe so, but it is interesting to me that Satan had created 12 years of misery for one woman, and now Jesus made her whole again. On the other hand, Satan was about to take 12 years of what no doubt was a delightful part of this family's life. Any family that has a little girl grow up from an infant to be 12 years old, there is just delight in those 12 years. It's a wonderful thing to experience and to see. A little child, a little girl, I had two little girls grow up, and what a precious time of life that is. And to have that marred at the age of 12 by that child's death, that would be bitterness and tragedy for the rest of the lives of those parents. And now that too is taken away. So we see Jesus' great power over the tools of Satan, sickness, death, demonic possession. All three of these cases of miracles that we've seen so far, Jesus is showing plainly his amazing power and his compassion for others. He commands them not to tell others about this miracle. Sometimes he does that. Sometimes he doesn't want it known more. He's already done so much on the western side of the Sea of Galilee. He really doesn't need his name spread right there any further. People are thronging him, as we saw already on this occasion. And maybe that's the reason he doesn't want them to tell. There might be other reasons. But at this point, he tells these people not to tell others about that. Jesus has been doing the impossible. But now, when we come to the first part of Mark chapter 6, he leaves the immediate area of the Sea of Galilee, still staying in the region of Galilee. He goes back home to Nazareth, which is about 20 miles up into the hills of central Galilee. It says in Mark chapter 6 and verse 1, he went out from there and came to his own country, and his disciples followed him. When the Sabbath had come, he began to teach in the synagogue, and many hearing him were astonished, saying, where did this man get these things? And what wisdom is this which is given to him, that such mighty works are performed by his hands? Is this not the carpenter, the son of Mary, the brother of James, Joseph, Judas, and Simon? And are not his sisters here with us? And they were offended at him. So Jesus goes to Nazareth. He teaches, perhaps in the synagogue. He does amazing signs. At least the people are aware of signs that he's done. But the people of his hometown and his home region are offended at him because he's the little boy who grew up here. We knew him when he was playing in the streets. We knew him when he was working with his father, perhaps in the carpenter shop. How can he be the Son of God? How can he be doing these miracles? How can he have this great teaching? They just don't think a lot of him. And Jesus, in response to that, says to them in verse 4, "A prophet is not without honor except in his own country, among his own relatives, in his own house." The Bible says that they were offended at Jesus. The word there means to be caused to stumble. You know, we can be caused to stumble sometimes. Perhaps somebody that we knew in their youth becomes a great Bible scholar and maybe even a wonderful preacher or teacher. But we remember when they were maybe the kid that was roaming the streets and causing mischief or this or that, and we find it hard to see them as a great Bible student or a great teacher, and so we might find it hard to sit at their feet and learn. And we're not saying at all that Jesus was mischievous or anything when he was a child. We know that he wasn't. But my point is, he was a child. He grew up as a boy in Nazareth. He lived a life of a human being in Nazareth as a boy growing up. Didn't reveal himself until, obviously, his public ministry starts. So these people stumble at who they think they know here. They can't believe in Jesus as God's son because they've known him as the son of Mary and Joseph. They've known his family. And they have trouble believing in him as the son of God. So the text tells us that Jesus sees that a prophet is honored, but not among those who are familiar with him. And so the text says that he could do no mighty work there except that he laid hands on a few sick people and healed them. So he did some miracles, but their unbelief, the miracles that he would do because they had faith in him, those pretty much he didn't do because they lacked faith. I'll just say this about that. You know, sometimes the point of a miracle was to help a person exhibit their faith. And so Jesus would heal people on the basis of their faith. But other times he would heal people regardless of whether or not they had any faith. Jesus certainly stilled the storm, regardless of, you know, what anybody thought about that. That was natural. But Jesus also, the man who had the unclean spirits, the legion of demons, what faith did he have? Well, we don't have any indication there. Jesus does a lot of miracles that don't require faith of the people, but then some do. And so those that required faith, I think, would be the ones that would be left off here in Nazareth. Well, we thank you for studying with us tonight. As we part, we'll show you a picture of modern Nazareth. It's a very large city, as I said. One of the things I want you to realize about this is so different from the Sea of Galilee and the placid lake that you have there. Here, very steep hills and deep valleys, and this is just not very far from the Jezreel Valley, the beautiful plain that runs crossways through the center of Israel. But the city of Nazareth, here's the topography of it that you see, much different place from where Jesus has been on the Sea of Galilee. Again, we thank you for studying with us tonight. I want to encourage you again to go to our website, eastside-church.org, and sign up for the correspondence course if you'd like. Also, if you want to get in touch with somebody here, either the elders or myself, our email addresses are there on our website, as well as the phone number of the church building. And if you need have a spiritual question or in some way we can help you, just feel free to let us know. Next week, we'll be looking in, again, still the Gospel of Mark, continuing this series of studies. We'll pick up in Mark chapter 6 and verse 7. We'll go all the way through chapter 6 and all the way through chapter 7. That will be lesson 5 in the correspondence course on the Gospel of Mark. So thank you again for studying with us.